Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, jet search suspended due to poor weather as satellites report more possible debris. Burma's Rohingya face census dilemma. Still no answers for family of Chinese activist who died in prison. These stories and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Poor weather conditions have again hampered the search for the missing Malaysian jet as aircraft were forced to suspend operations due to low cloud cover. As Ron Corbin reports, the setback Thursday came as newly released satellite imagery from Thailand detected hundreds of objects floating in the southern Indian Ocean.
Wild weather conditions forced search aircraft to suspend operations again Thursday, highlighting the enormous challenge facing the half-dozen nations scouring the southern Indian Ocean for missing Malaysian jet MH370, which disappeared March 8. It was the second occasion this week that the search effort for the flight, with its 239 passengers and crew, had to be suspended due to poor weather. A Chinese search aircraft in an illusion IL-76 was one of those aircraft forced to return to Perth, Australia, where search operations are being coordinated. Zhang Bing, the captain of the aircraft, said the plane had flown as low as 700 metres, but visibility was affected by cloud cover. Zhang said the aircraft had arrived at the search area on schedule but faced very bad weather conditions and was ordered by Australia to cut short the search and return to base. Meanwhile, a Thai satellite detected some 300 suspected objects near the search area for the missing Boeing 777. The objects, reported to be between 2 and 10 metres in size, were photographed 3 days ago, roughly 200 kilometres away from a previous sighting by a French satellite. But so far, none of the spotted items have been conclusively linked to the missing aircraft. Of the 227 passengers on board the MH370, 153 were Chinese. In China, frustrations over the search effort have led authorities to pressure Malaysian authorities to release more information. On Thursday in Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei again called for more accurate information from Malaysia on the details of the search. He said China would step up efforts in the search for the missing aircraft. He said he hoped Malaysia would also improve its communications with China and work with all relevant countries in the search and console passengers' families. Some aviation analysts are becoming skeptical of efforts to locate debris more than 2 weeks after the aircraft went down in a remote part of the Indian Ocean. Hugh Ritchie, chief executive of Aviation Consultants International, said there is growing doubt that the items captured on satellite imagery are linked to the Boeing 777 jet.
I'm still relatively sceptical. I'm very dubious whether or not these pieces of flotsam and jetsam and stuff which are being out there are in actual fact from the aircraft. It's 18-odd days since this occurred to be still floating out there. Most of the things, if they were being were able to float, would probably be under the water now anyway, and waterlogged. Aeroplanes of this nature aren't built to float.
Searchers are scrambling to locate the main body of the aircraft that contains the black box, flight and voice recorder, which could contain important clues about the flight's disappearance. But experts say the device, which sends pings when in contact with water, likely only has enough battery to transmit its location for another 2 weeks. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Tensions continue to escalate on the Korean Peninsula, with both sides trading allegations and South Korea seizing a North Korean fishing boat that strayed into its waters. The South Korean military Thursday said the ship sailed nearly 2 kilometers south of the maritime border and refused warnings to return to the north. The three crew members have been taken into custody while officials in Seoul conduct an investigation. Officials say the men do not appear to be trying to defect and want to go home. The Philippine government and the country's largest Muslim rebel group have signed a peace accord to end decades of fighting that have left more than 120,000 dead. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
More than 1,000 people gathered Thursday at the presidential palace grounds in Manila to witness the lead negotiators of the government and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front sign what is being called the Comprehensive Agreement. Moro Islamic Liberation Front Chairman Alhaj Murad Ibrahim says the pact is a shared victory for all the residents of Muslim-majority Mindanao, including Christians and indigenous peoples, and the rest of the country. He says it restores the identity, powers, and resources of the residents, who are called Bangsa Moro.
These three things, which have been ours since time immemorial, unjustly taken through colonization and occupation, are now returned to us.
For nearly 40 years, Muslim rebels fought for the right to self-determination in the southern island of Mindanao. The agreement follows 17 years of on and off negotiations. It creates a self-governing region to be called Bangsa Moro, which will have a parliamentary form of government with the ability to raise its own revenues and form its own law enforcement. The central government in Manila would oversee national defense, currency, and postal services. The new region would replace the autonomous region in Muslim Mindanao, which was formed under a 1996 pact with a smaller rebel group. The current administration calls the ARMM, which has the highest poverty rate in the country, a failed experiment. The pact calls for disarming the rebels and private armed groups which operate in the region. Conflict resolution experts say its success depends on the central government's ability to deal with smaller factions that are not happy with the agreement. They say the justice system needs to be strengthened to stop the regular practice of residents settling grievances with arms. At the signing, President Benigno Aquino said the region would need a significant boost up so it could catch up to the rest of the country. He also had stern words for opponents of the deal.
Those who wish to sow divisiveness for self-interest and those who continue to wield arms to pursue their own agendas. So many people have suffered for so long. So many of our stakeholders have worked so hard to arrive at this point. I will not let peace be snatched from my people again.
Ibrahim, a former top-ranking commander with the MILF's armed forces, says he is overwhelmed with happiness at the signing, but he reiterates the need to be vigilant as both sides work to carry out the terms of the compact. The deal is on a tight timeline because officials want everything in place in time for the 2016 elections. A transition committee is drafting a law that would be the basis for forming the Bangsa Moro region. The Philippines Congress has to approve the measure, which negotiators want passed by the end of this year. Residents of the proposed area will vote in a referendum next year to determine whether they want to be included in the new entity. Once its borders are defined, they will elect leaders during the 2016 national elections. That is also when President Aquino's term ends. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
We have the full story on our VOA Asia Facebook page. Be sure to like us there, and you may follow us all day, every day on Twitter. You can look me up at VOA Stevenson. Burma is conducting its first census in more than three decades, at a time when ethnic and religious tensions are high. Census workers are expected to record each person's race and religion, which pose some problems for ethnic Rohingya Muslims who are not recognized as Burmese citizens. Gabrielle Pollack reports from Yangon.
Burma's government does not officially recognize some ethnic groups that have long lived within its borders. But the upcoming census requires they be counted under one of the country's officially recognized ethnicities. Stateless ethnic Rohingya Muslims, most of whom are living in conflict-stricken Rakhine State, are among those who will have to identify as other and write in their ethnicity. Population Minister Kin Yi suggests that those who write in Rohingya could face prosecution for providing misinformation. He refers to the Rohingya as Bengali, reflecting government policy that considers them foreigners from Bangladesh. He does not expect problems in Sitwe, the capital of Rakhine.
We did not do a test census in Sitwe in Rakhine State because at the time there was a conflict between the two communities. We have since discussed the two communities, Rakhine and Bengali, and they accept the census process. Because the census process is all-inclusive, those who don't participate will lose their chance.
Observers worry that the ethnic and religious identification questions could worsen ostracism of some communities. But UN technical advisors say it's too late and too expensive to change the questionnaire. In the lead-up to the census, the extremist anti-Muslim monk Wiratu has delivered well-attended speeches in Rakhine State about protecting race and religion and has led protests advocating a census boycott. Here, Wiratu is accusing Muslims of targeting monks and terrorizing good people. He says authorities should kick out international aid groups that help Muslims. He also says Muslims should be denied citizenship and marriage rights. Za A is a minister for Rakhine Nationalities Affairs who is concerned about ongoing violence in his hometown. He says the situation will improve if people stop identifying themselves as Rohingya.
Putting the name of a people that don't exist will cause violence. But if they're counted as Bengalis, there won't be any problems.
Jamin is a Rohingya politician who says many fear identifying as Rohingya will threaten their legal status, but not identifying as Rohingya will leave their community underrepresented.
I am Rohingya. I will enlist as Rohingya. I think the enumerators will also write me as Rohingya because they have the duty according to census law. Claiming an ethnicity is not the question of violence. Who will initiate the violence? It is the question.
Burma's nationwide census begins at the end of this month. This is Gabrielle Pollock reporting for VOA News from Rangoon.
The lawyer and family of a Chinese rights activist who died earlier this month while in government custody are trying to get some answers about what killed her. They say they are appealing to the government through legal channels, but so far have received only threats in response. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong for VOA.
The day Cao Shunli died, March 14th, her brother and sister were called to a hospital in Beijing and saw their sister's dead body. Cao Yunli, Cao's brother, says police and doctors were in the room and her sister looked extremely emaciated and thin. Since then, the family has been denied access to Cao's body. Authorities say Cao Shunli suffered from prolonged illness and died of tuberculosis in spite of rescue efforts. But Cao's family insists that she did not receive treatment in prison, and repeated requests for medical parole went unanswered. Beijing-based lawyer Wang Yu has been following Cao's case since September, when authorities barred Cao Shunli from boarding a plane to Geneva and put her under detention. Cao was scheduled to participate in a discussion at the United Nations about human rights in China. Wang says the family now wants an investigation into the cause of her death and prosecution for the people responsible. She says a third party, like the United Nations, should participate in the investigation. Cao Shunli had been staging peaceful sit-ins in front of the Foreign Ministry building in Beijing, asking for more grassroots participation into the Universal Periodic Review, a UN mechanism that routinely reviews the human rights record of member countries. In its official response to the UN, adopted by the Human Rights Council 5 days after Cao's death, the government wrote, "There's no such issue of suppressing human rights defenders in China." But Cao Shunli's death has drawn concern from human rights groups and UN authorities, including Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Last week in Geneva, Beijing objected and interrupted a minute of silence proposed by NGOs in memory of Cao Shunli's death. While China insists it treats all citizens on the basis of the law, people who petition for politically sensitive issues are rarely granted due process or a fair trial. Efforts by their lawyers to find justice are also hampered. Wang Yu, Cao's lawyer, says she and Cao's family have been subjected to intimidation since they started investigating Cao's death. Authorities discouraged Cao's family from further pursuing the case, Wang Yu says officers from the local security bureau sent phone messages to her husband and visited their home. She says they made references to Liu Xiaofang, a close friend of Cao Xunli and fellow activist who has recently disappeared. What they meant is that I could be next, one says, but I didn't do anything illegal, so they wouldn't have reason to detain me at this point, she adds. In China, lawyers who defend dissidents or other sensitive clients are heavily monitored and run the risk of being prosecuted themselves. A week ago, four well-known human rights lawyers were detained in the northern province of Heilongjiang after they attempted to visit an illegal detention center known as a black jail and file a lawsuit to the local court. Rebecca Valli for VOA in Hong Kong.
Michelle Obama has returned to the United States from her trip to China. Our web poll of the week is about whether the First Lady should bring up controversial topics or not during visits. You can vote at voanews.com/daybreakasia. Time to head out to the movies. The great American author Mark Twain once wrote a long time ago that clothes make the man. He's got a point. But in today's modern world, one can also say clothes make the woman. A new documentary about South Korea's fashion pioneer proves it, as VOA's Ray Kugel tells us.
It's not too often you can meet someone completely original, but when you do, there is always a history of accomplishment and drive that makes the person special. Nora Ngo is the embodiment of those qualities. She is the subject and name of a new film about her life. Ngo is a South Korean fashion designer who overcame many of life's challenges to ultimately become the country's major influence on women's fashions for more than 60 years. Ngo was born in Seoul in 1928. She married at 17 to escape working in a factory or becoming a comfort woman for Japanese soldiers in 1944. But the marriage failed, and 2 years later she divorced, an unusual move for Korean women at the time. Ngo decided to go it alone, and in 1947 went off to study in the United States. That's where she also took the name Nora, after the character in Henrik Ibsen's play A Dollhouse, who broke free from her home to find herself. Ngo returned to Korea to begin her career styling clothes in the 1950s with an elite customer base and costume designing for Korean movies. But it changed dramatically in 1956 when she put together the country's first fashion show featuring clothes with simpler styles, shedding tradition and providing more comfort. Over the next two decades, Ngo challenged societal norms, turning out hugely successful and affordable ready-made clothes, following that with the introduction of the miniskirt. Ngo's creations later graced the covers of Vogue and Bizarre magazines and were displayed in Macy's department store in New York during the 1980s. The documentary Nora Ngo is directed by Sung Hee Kim, who examines, in beautiful detail, the hardships and accomplishments against the backdrop of a rapidly changing Korean society. I spoke with a Seoul-based director about this amazing 86-year-old woman and the motivation to make the film about her life.
I found out that Nora Ngo's fashion style and fashion story is very much linked to Korean popular culture and also the model of women of Korea. So I decided to do a documentary about her fashion story, which can be linked to those two main subjects.
How did Nora Ngo get her ideas or get her eye for designing clothes with such colors and style?
In the time when she was born, Western style was not so much popular in Korea. And so she was considered as modern woman of Korea. And she was very much affected by her study in America and France. And also her fashion philosophy that clothes should make people confident and comfortable was how she developed her unique style of clothes.
Do you think Nora No's fashion designs will continue to have a lasting influence in Korea despite the easy access now to other international styles and trends?
Whether visible or not, she has made a great impact on Korean style, like clothing style, especially in the 60s and 70s, shaping the popular culture, spreading the new vibe of clothing style along with popular personas such as Pearl Sisters and Yunbokki. And so she designed clothes that made sensation in those times. And I think this will continue to have an impact on Korean clothing style.
How are Nora No's designs currently being received elsewhere in Asia?
In Nora No's times, she made a lot of achievement in terms of influencing countries such as China, U.S. and Japan, especially in the 70s, by exporting clothes she has made and the style she created.
Is there a renewed interest in Nora No's work since this film came out?
For now, stories about history of Korean fashion is not so much accumulated, and a lot of young people don't know about her. But this movie is shedding light on this new discovery of fashion designer, and young people are also getting interested in getting to know about her and also the history of Korean fashion.
Nora No possesses a great inner strength. For you, how was it to work with her on your movie?
For 3 years, I worked with Nora No. And it was not so easy working with a woman over 80, for she had far more experience and knowledge. And sometimes I had to go through some adjustments in parts that we did not agree. And after filming the movie, I feel that we could have had more conversation in making each other's opinions well known to each other.
Do you own any Nora No clothes?
Unfortunately, no, I don't own Nora No's clothes, since her clothes are generally mostly for middle-aged or old generations. And frankly, I usually wear working clothes, so yeah, I didn't get a chance to wear her clothes.
And you don't have to wear Nora No's clothes either to enjoy Kim's fascinating documentary. Using voiceovers, archival film, photographs, interviews with former customers, celebrities, and a dynamic musical score, this is more than a detailed biography. It is also a story about the courage to be different. In No's own words, you can't make it on your own with no spine. You need a strong will to live life your way. Such reasoning is far beyond the exquisite use of patterns, scissors, and thread. I'm Ray Kugel.
Ray would like to remind us that you can get more information on the film, Nora No, by going to the website www.cinemadal.com. That's C-I-N-E-M-A-D-A-L. And then you can go to the film directory category. Also, stop by our Facebook page at VOA Asia and like us, and our program page, voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. We invite you to stay tuned for the latest world news next on International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website,